It is good to be together, and as it was last week, I am really thankful that we can be together, because as I said then, this matters. Our gathering together, our joining together, this matters, right? We are created to be in relationship, called to do life together. And so this matters, keeping in mind that at the very heart and center of our gathering together is Jesus, is to follow Jesus, to seek the way of Jesus. What is, in a word, discipleship? What is, in a word, discipleship? To be and to become disciples. And at the very heart and center of what it means to be a disciple is, first off, as it was in Jesus' day, to learn your rabbi's yoke. To learn your rabbi, to learn Jesus' yoke, meaning his teachings, his philosophy, his worldview, his theology, his interpretation of Torah. And with that, not only was your aim to learn your rabbi's yoke, right, in essence, to think like he thinks and to know like he knows, not only to think and know, but also to do. Right? Because the ultimate goal of a disciple was to become just like your rabbi, was to become just like Jesus. The author Dallas Willard, he says, in effect, to live as Jesus would live. Right, to do life as Jesus does life, noting, as we have in these past weeks, that Jesus, our rabbi, is one who does prayer. Jesus, our rabbi, he's one who does prayer, who practices the way of prayer, and consequently, we are called to be a people who pray. And for that reason, these past couple of weeks and into these coming weeks ahead and today, I want to invite us again to dive into this thing we call prayer, to consider prayer as it was in Jesus' day, and to maybe even join Jesus then in this pursuit of prayer, a practice that has an absolutely rich history. We saw evidence of this last week, where we noted Jesus was in the midst of some very, very real struggles and challenges. And in the midst of those struggles and challenges, what does he do? But it says he prays to the Father, and he says, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth. Jesus opens his mouth in the midst of that difficulty, and he says, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth. I praise you, which is an interesting statement, especially as it is a reflection of Psalm 51 and 15. Psalm 51 and 15 again declares, open my lips, Lord, and my mouth will declare your praise. And that is interesting because Psalm 51, 15 opens what is called the Amidah, aka the Shmona Esrei, aka Hatfilah, which means simply the prayer. That translates simply as the prayer, hatfilah. What is the prayer at the very core of every Jewish service? What is the prayer at the heart of ancient Jewish liturgy, going back 2,500 years ago, back to the 5th century BC? What is the prayer that was and is recited three times a day? What is the prayer at the backdrop of Jesus' own prayer life? A prayer that begins with praise. Not only in its use of Psalm 51 and 15, but in the context of the first three benedictions or first three blessings of the Amidah, noting from the Rabbi Joshua Cohn, using the image of master and servant, the rabbis declared that a worshiper should come before their master first with words of praise. First with words of praise. And it's these first three of 19 blessings that are in the Amidah that are really an offering of praise. From the opening line of the Amidah, the Shmona Esrei, the Hatfilah, we read, blessed are you, Yahweh, our God and the God of our forefathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, the great and awesome God, the supreme God, who bestows beneficial kindnesses and creates everything, who recalls the kindnesses of the patriarchs and brings a redeemer to their children's children for his name's sake with love. O King, helper, savior, and shield, blessed are you, Yahweh, shield of Abraham. It continues, you are eternally mighty, Yahweh, the resuscitator of the dead, and are you abundantly able to save, who sustains the living with kindness, resuscitates the dead with abundant mercy, supports the fallen, heals the sick, releases the confined, maintains his faith to those asleep in the dust. Who is like you, O master of mighty deeds, and who is comparable to you, O king, who causes death and restores life and makes salvation sprout? And you are faithful to resuscitate the dead. Blessed are you, Yahweh, who resuscitates the dead. You are holy, and your name is holy, and holy ones praise you every day forever, for you are God, the great and holy King. Blessed are you, Yahweh, the holy God. Thus begins the Amidah, what are considered the first three blessings of the Amidah. Now, there is a whole lot here in these first three benedictions. We could spend hours and hours going through it. We won't do that, to which you can say thank you. I'm not going to do that, but I do want to draw our attention to a couple of things. For one, I want us just to quickly notice some names here. Names like Yahweh, God of our forefathers, great God, awesome God, supreme God, creator of everything, King, helper, savior, shield, sustains the living, master of mighty deeds, resuscitates the dead. With that, though, I also want us to notice that at the close of this praise section, we read, you are holy, and your name is holy. Blessed are you, Yahweh, the holy God. Which is also interesting, especially when we turn to the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. And so that's where I want to go for the remainder of our time, mostly. So page 735 in your pew Bible, Luke 11, opening verse is where we're going to hang out. The words will be on the screen behind me. In fact, in this particular passage, Jesus is hanging out with his disciples. And it opens with one day. One day, a rather generic term. It could be one day. Could be any day. It could be every day. It could be that day. It could be this day. One day, Jesus was praying, and it says then, in a certain place. Again, rather generic. That could be any place or every place. That could be that place or this place. And so one day, this day, Jesus was praying in a certain place, this place. And then we read, when he had finished, one of his disciples said to him, when he had finished, one of his disciples said to him, which is really thoughtful, meaning this disciple, for whatever reason, decided that he wasn't going to interrupt Jesus in his time of prayer. Right, how nice. And so we can think, well, yes, absolutely, that's thoughtful, that's kind, that's compassionate, right? He has patience. But we can also ask, why did Luke put in that phrase? Why did Luke want to write that phrase, when he had finished? Why did he want us to notice that? And well, some of the backdrop for that is actually found in the Mishnah, what is the gathering up of Jewish oral law into a written form. And according to oral law recorded in the Mishnah, when praying the Amidah, it says in Brachot 5 and 1, standing in prayer, and notice that it begins standing in prayer. Amidah means standing. And so this is a prayer that you say when you are standing. It's the standing prayer. And so speaking of the Amidah here, standing in prayer is standing before God. And as such, even if the king greets him, he, the one praying, should not respond to him. And even if a snake is wrapped on his heel, he should not interrupt his prayer. Which I know for some of you, it's like good luck, right? Like, I don't know, this whole Mishnah Bro, that's a snake on my ankle. I don't know. So as was oral law, right? The point being that as was oral law, the disciple waits. And when he had finished praying, when Jesus had finished praying, one of the disciples said to him, Lord, teach us to pray, just as John taught his disciples. And not only John, but this was an absolutely common practice. Chaim Goldstein, director of the Messianic Bible Project. He notes many rabbis formulated their own prayers, just as Yeshua, Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, did for his followers. Each prayer incorporated spiritual petitions and principles significant to that rabbi. So when Yeshua's, Jesus' disciples, asked him, Lord, teach us to pray, they were likely asking for a personalized prayer of principles, petitions, important to Messiah himself. And so Jesus said to them, to his followers, to his disciples, to you and me, he says, when you pray, say, Father, hallowed be your name. The name, which according to the Amidah, is holy. Which is also interesting, noting that hallowed be is from the Greek word hagiazo, and it means to treat a thing or a person with hagios, which can be translated holy, which is translated as holy. And so with that, it carries this idea of to sanctify or to revere. And so something set apart from other things could be considered holy, hagios, right? If someone is given a certain amount of reverence, right? Regarded with respect and reverence. This is hagios. This is holy. So hallowed be your name becomes hagiazo, your name. Sanctify, set apart, revere your name. And then we put this in the passive tense, which hagiazo is actually in the passive tense here. It can be translated and it is translated. Let your name be holy, sanctified. Let your name be honored. Let your name be revered above all other names. William Barclay, he translates it like this. He says, O Father, let your name be held in reverence. Meaning, the flip of that is that we are the ones doing the revering. Right? Yahweh, holy is your name. Your name is holy. Your name is holy. Now, with that, we need to get at names here just for a moment and to kind of take it from an ancient Hebraic understanding of names, because names are far more than just a name. From the scholar Leon Morris, the name in antiquity meant a good deal more than it does with us. We use it for personal designation, and that is about all. But in antiquity, the name was held to be bound up with the person in some way. The name and the qualities associated with the name went together. Again, from William Barclay, he adds this. He says, in Hebrew, the name does not mean simply the name by which a person is called, John or James or whatever the name may be. In Hebrew, the name means the nature, the character, the personality of the person insofar as it is known or revealed to us. And we can see this play out. We see this play out in Psalm 9, verse 10. We read, those who know your name trust in you, for you, Yahweh, have never forsaken those who seek you. The point here is not that God is called Yahweh. The point is that his nature, his character, his personality is one of trustworthiness. Psalm 20 and 7, the same idea. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Again, the point is not in the midst of all the difficulties and the struggles. The point is not in the name, in remembering the name, but rather remembering the nature, the character, the personality of God. And again, that he is trustworthy. From the scholar Craig Keener, hallowing God's name was the most characteristic feature of Jewish ethics, along with its opposite, profaning the name. Again, from Morris, the prayer means more than using the divine name with suitable reverence. It includes that and is thus a standing witness against every age that uses the name of God or Jesus or Christ lightly in oaths or a jest, but, and pay attention to this, but it also means that we should be reverent before all that God is and stands for. If God's name is hallowed, all is held in proper reverence. Which kind of begs the question then, well, what would that look like for you and me? What would that look like today in our world? What would it look like to hold God, to hold God's name in proper reverence? Right? To keep, as the Amida says, his name as holy. Well, toward that end, just a couple of thoughts to bring this to a close. First, I would say that reverence begins with the belief that God exists. Begins with the belief that God exists. And the biblical revelation, the biblical perspective, is that the existence of God is self-evident. It's a self-evident truth. Right? God was and is revealed, experienced in his presence, experienced in his creation. We read in Romans, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. Psalm 19, opening verse, we read, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. The existence of God is revealed to us in and through what has been made. The clergyman William Paley from the 1800s, he told a story and told it like this. He said, suppose a man is walking along the road. He strikes his foot against a watch lying in the dust. He has never in his life seen a watch before. He does not know what it is. He picks it up. He sees it, that it consists of a metal case, and inside the case, a complicated arrangement of wheels, levers, springs, and jewels. He sees that the whole thing is moving and working in the most orderly way. He sees further, that the hands are moving round and round the dial in an obviously predetermined routine. What then does he say? Does he say all these metals and jewels came together from the ends of the earth by chance? By chance made themselves into wheels and levers and springs? By chance assembled themselves into this mechanism? By chance wound themselves up and set themselves going? By chance acquired their obvious orderly working? No. He says, I have found a watch. Somewhere, there must be a watchmaker. This idea that in a sense, order presupposes something more than just chance. In the words of the German philosopher Kant, he says, the moral law within us and the starry heavens above us drive us to God. Right, a reverence for God, a hallowing of his holy name, that sort of deep recognition, right, that all of creation is a testimony and a gift from him. Inviting us to kind of ask ourselves, do we look at creation and say, somewhere there must be a world maker? Do we look at creation and say, somewhere there must be a world maker? And to break that down, we could ask, do we give thanks to God for his creation? Do we give thanks to God for his creation? We could ask, do we recognize and honor his character as seen in creation? Do we marvel at the nature of God, the nature, the character, the personality of God revealed in his handiwork? A revelation, by the way, that is not confined to certain times or places, not confined certainly to Sunday mornings or to church buildings. I stand by what I said in the beginning, that it is good to gather together, and I'm thankful that we are gathering together, and it's important, and it matters. recognizing also that my experience of God is often when I'm climbing a mountain somewhere, when I'm out in the midst of nature. And I do experience God's presence when I'm here with you, when we can be together, share in life together. As Barclay notes, to show reverence for God means to live in a God-filled world. To show reverence for God means to live in a God-filled world. The poet William Wordsworth, from the late 18th century, perhaps his most famous poem titled Tintern Abbey. I think he captures the heart of this kind of mindfulness. He writes, "And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky, and in the mind of man and woman, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things." From the late clergyman Henry Hardy, co-founder of the Society of Divine Compassion, I think he also captures this in Mystic Beauty, in his poem, The Mystic Beauty. "O London town has many moods, and mingled amongst its many broods, a leavening of saints. And ever up and down its streets, if one has eyes to see, one meets stuff that an artist paints. I've seen a back street bathed in blue, such as the soul of Whistler knew, a smudge of amber light, where some fried fish shop plied its trade, a perfect note of color made. Oh, it was exquisite. I once came through St. James Park, betwixt the sunset and the dark, and oh, the mystery of gray and green and violet. I would I never might forget that evening harmony. I hold it true that God is there, if beauty breaks through anywhere, and his most blessed feet, who once life's roughest roadway trod, came as man to show us God, still pass along the street." Which leads me to ask, and we'll close with this, do we live with a mindful awareness of the presence of God? Do we live with a mindful awareness of the presence of God? Yes, when you're out there, but also when you're in here. Mindful of the presence of God that is here in this room, in those around you. It matters that we gather together. Do we live with a mindful awareness of the presence of God? The trouble, writes William Barclay, the trouble with most people is that our awareness of God is spasmodic, acute at certain times and places, totally absent at others. Reverence means the constant awareness of God. Reverence means the constant awareness of God. Do we live with a mindful awareness of the presence of God? And we can think of Wordsworth, we can think of Hardy, right, in the light of setting suns, the round ocean, the air, the blue sky, man and woman. Right, God present in the back streets and in the parks and in the fried fish shops. Do we live with a mindful awareness of the presence of God? And I would suggest it's in that space that we can offer up our praise. Blessed are you, Yahweh, you are holy, and your name is holy. Hallowed be your name.